Thank you. Our fourth case this morning is Brown versus Department of Corrections.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Why don't you wait till everybody gets up here? Okay. Now you can proceed.
All right. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Nathan Roberts here for the appellant, Ayanna and Lewis Brown. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
2 minutes.
We're seeking reversal this morning of the trial court's grant of summary judgment in this matter. The trial court's order improperly invaded the province of the jury, weighed evidence and inferences in light of the favor of the moving party, contrary to the summary judgment standard, on two important issues of fact.
Well, our review is de novo.
Correct.
So frankly, it doesn't matter what the trial court did. So the question here has to do with whether the discovery rule tolls the statute of limitations. And that turns on whether there was due diligence. And so in the briefing, there's a back and forth discussion between your brief and DOC's brief about whether there was due diligence. So perhaps you could focus on that.
I'm happy to jump to due diligence, Your Honor. What I would say about the due diligence in this case and the problem with the trial court's ruling is that the trial court created a bright line rule about what due diligence is.
But it doesn't matter.
Right. It flies in the face of the Supreme Court case law saying that's an issue of fact for the jury. And in this case,
well, you can have cases where reasonable minds could only reach one conclusion. I mean, you look at Allen.
Allen is such a case.
So in Allen, the court said on these facts, there was no due diligence. So, I mean, frankly, it doesn't matter what the trial court said. I think we're bound by the case law, and we are looking at this de novo.
Right. And I do like Allen. I like Allen. The law in Allen is good. And I want to distinguish it at the outset because it's the elephant in the room for my client, correct? So what Allen does not say is Allen does not spell out a list of things that a potential plaintiff has to do in order to check the due diligence box. What Allen says is that if your husband is murdered and you have only brief contact with law enforcement, that falls off, and you drop out of touch with the prosecutor, and they arrest the guy and try him, and you don't go to any of the proceedings, and you don't go to the trial, and you don't read about it in the newspaper, and your family hides the newspaper from you because you've decided that the best thing for you is to put your head in the sand and try to get over it, that's not due diligence. And when you look at what my clients did in this case...
Before we get there, and just looking at Allen, here we have someone who does have criminal history, and that's clear. In Allen, the court says that in that case the individual had recently been in prison for previous homicides, that would have put Allen on notice to inquire further. How do you address that part of Allen?
I would say, Your Honor, that my clients did inquire further, and that as the parents of a 12-year-old who was shot and killed, not educated as we all are in the law, but only in trying to explore the facts and hold everyone accountable, they investigated further by showing up at every single court proceeding involving this perpetrator where anyone was on the record and he was present in court, including the arraignment, where his probationary status was not mentioned on the record once,
right,
including the entire trial, where his probationary status, I believe, was kept from the jury, up until and including the sentencing when they were present in court and spoke to the judge about the appropriate sentence.
Does due diligence include looking at the court file?
That is a question of fact for the jury, Your Honor. I think as lawyers, it's very tempting for us to say, yeah, we should do that because I think we would know to look there. We might go there. Allen does not say, no case is held, that as a matter of law, grieving family members of the deceased victim have to go to court, listen to the proceedings, and then after court, go down to the clerk's office to see what's been filed in addition to what's being said in open court. Or that in addition to talking to the detectives and prosecutors, they need to request, under the Public Records Act, volumes of lengthy legal materials and scan through them with a fine-tooth comb to see if there's a reference in there to something they're not even aware they should be looking for.
So in the record, it's clear that your clients did talk to the detectives.
Correct.
And they were in attendance at each day of the trial and sentencing and arraignment. Did they talk to the prosecutors? I don't remember seeing that in the record.
I believe they did, Your Honor, or to the victim advocate. I would have to review their declarations to see if that's reflected. But the point that I'm trying to make, the overarching point, Your Honor, is that...
that they were very involved.
They were the antithesis...
Of Mrs. Allen.
Of Mrs. Allen, in every way imaginable. And if you read Allen, Allen suggests that the type of diligence that Mr. and Mrs. Brown engaged in would allow them to benefit from the discovery rule if, for example, they had learned of the perpetrator's history or the probationary status at trial, and that's at 759 in the Allen opinion. It says, Allen could have discovered her cause of action during May 1982, and it goes on to say, in that month, her husband's murderers were convicted into trial, which received considerable attention in the local newspapers.
And so, now we get to the newspaper articles, because DOC is heavily relying on the newspaper articles that they presented to the trial court and have referenced in briefings. So why would the newspaper articles not have put your clients on notice that they needed to take additional steps?
Because the standard is a reasonable person, Your Honor, and it's for the jury to determine whether a reasonable person not only goes to all the court hearings involving the death of their son and works with the prosecutor and sees the process through, but then also is expected to leave court and read about Comeforce coverage. And I don't think there will ever be a case where...
Well, Allen seems to spend a fair amount of time talking about the newspaper reporting and that information was available by reading the newspapers.
And I believe, Your Honor, that Allen says this is not due diligence, and here's why. Because there were five or six different ways for potentially the Allen plaintiffs to learn about the facts underlying their cause of action.
So it,
and
wasn't,
they didn't avail
just,
themselves.
It wasn't just the newspaper then?
Correct. And if I may, Your Honor, it wasn't. Allen doesn't say you have to do one, two, three, four, and five. Allen says here are five or six different ways you could have figured this out, and you didn't do any of them. So it's hard for me to imagine a case involving the discovery rule where a defendant couldn't say later, with the benefit of hindsight, well, if the plaintiff had only done X, if they'd only made a Public Records Act request, or if they'd only called DOC and asked about the availability of the probationary status. The legal standard is not Monday morning quarterbacking on the plaintiff. It's a subjective standard. It's for the jury to determine under the circumstances whether their efforts were reasonable and whether they were reasonably diligent. And I would submit to the court that the only real evidence we have about their diligence is set forth in their declarations, Ion and Lewis Brown's, and that they were the definition of diligence in pursuing justice for everyone who was responsible for their son's murder, including the perpetrator, and including upon learning for the first time at sentencing that not only was he on probation when he committed the murder, but that there were other pre-existing probation violations that had gone unaddressed, his drug dealing, his gun possessing, that they took action within a reasonable amount of time. And that's for the jury to decide.
But it's not a subjective standard. As you said, it's a reasonable person standard.
Reasonable person. And
It's not subjective.
In theory, it's not, Your Honor. We let the jurors objectively decide what a reasonable person would do.
That is correct.
It's not a reasonable, I want to emphasize, it's not a reasonable lawyer or judge. It's a reasonable grieving parent of a 12-year-old. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alicia Young, Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Washington State Department of Corrections. This Court should affirm Allen controls this case, and the trial court properly applied Allen because there is no evidence that the Browns...
Isn't this case just factually distinguishable from Allen, though?
It's not, Your Honor. In Allen, the determinative factor, and under the discovery rule, the determinative factor is whether or not the plaintiffs could have learned the factual basis for their cause of action. No amount of due diligence in the world is relevant if the plaintiffs couldn't have learned the factual basis for their cause of action.
So if it's there to find and you don't find it, then you haven't exercised due diligence.
That's correct.
Okay.
Would that include making a Public Records Act request?
It could. It's discovery rule is contextual in different cases, but certainly in this case where we have a newspaper article, a Seattle Times newspaper article, in which the plaintiffs themselves were extensively quoted and pictured in the article, and that article not only identified the perpetrator and his criminal history and the fact that he was on DOC supervision, but also linked the readers of the article to the actual criminal charging documents.
So which what is the CP for that article?
It's at Clerk's Paper 79.
So plaintiff appellant says Allen's distinguishable, if I understand correctly, because there's an overall lack of effort. There's just an absence of evidence.
Sure.
Here, it's contested. So wouldn't that be a jury question?
The facts underlying what the Browns did is not contested. So the Browns certainly were diligent in following their son's, the criminal trial of the perpetrator who very tragically murdered their son. Absolutely, we don't disagree with that. But the question is whether or not the Browns were diligent in discovering their civil cause of action.
Well, isn't it due diligence?
Absolutely. And so here, the Browns did not, there's no evidence of the record of any requests or inquiries that they made that were unanswered. There's no, while they say they attended the trial and they attended the arraignment and the sentencing, there's no suggestion that they asked anyone any information and didn't learn a response to that inquiry. And in fact, again, in the Seattle Times, Mr. Walker was identified as on DOC supervision.
And again, this is CP 79?
CP 79, yes. And there are several other articles in the record as well following that article.
Well, there are some articles that just reference criminal history. There
That's
are other
true.
Online articles that have a passing reference to.
That's true.
To on probation.
That's true. The information varies per article, but
could you ever exercise due diligence and not be successful in finding something? Is that possible?
I think the question would be whether or not the information was reasonably available to the plaintiffs.
No, my question to you was, could you ever exercise due diligence and not be successful in finding a piece of information?
If the information was not reasonably available, yes. I thought that would be my answer.
And something obtainable by a Public Records Act request is reasonably available?
In this case, certainly it is. And the
what case law puts the burden on a plaintiff to make a public records request in a case like this?
There's not a case exactly like this, but there are a couple cases I would refer the court to. First of all, in the Shepherd v. Holmes case, the Court of Appeals held that matters of public record are, quote, easily ascertainable and serve as constructive notice to all the world.
Wasn't that a Recording Act case, though?
It was, yes.
I mean, isn't that a little bit different? I mean, we learned that basically in law school, that if you record something at the recording office, it's the whole world is deemed to have knowledge of it.
That's true.
That's
but the
very
question,
different than what we have here, isn't it?
It is a little different, but the question was whether or not something had been fraudulently concealed. And it wasn't the fact that there was information recorded. It was the fact that the actual basis for the concealment was in the document that had that was a public record. Slightly different, but I understand Your Honor's point. The other case law that I would point the court to is that the case law squarely puts the burden on the plaintiff to show facts underlying their claim were not and could not have been discovered by due diligence. And that's the GW Construction case, 70 Win App at 367, the Clare case, 129 Win App at 603, and in the Allen case itself. By June 17th, 2010, it was indisputably public knowledge that Curtis Walker killed the Brown sons, that he was on DOC supervision, that he had been in violation of his supervision.
Okay, now let's just stop there. What in the record would put the Browns on notice that he was on supervision when their child was killed?
The June 17th Seattle Times article, which is at CP 79. The charging documents that were filed the same day, referenced in the article, and linked to the article.
Again, that would mean that they would have to go obtain copies of those documents because there was no reference in the arraignment to prior convictions.
Well, they had to click on the link in the Seattle Times article to obtain those documents, yes. Or ask the prosecutor, who they had alleged they had been in constant contact with, or ask law enforcement, or ask the reporter who interviewed them for the Seattle Times article, or ask the court, or ask the prosecutor's office through a public records request. Any of those options.
Let's follow up on that, Shelton. What if they chose to read it in paper. I know that's ancient technology now, but they would read the paper as opposed to clicking on the link.
Sure.
They wouldn't have found the charging
documents. They would have found reference to the charging documents. The article says documents released Thursday reveal that the shooter, and then that they're referencing this is where all this information comes from, including the fact that Walker had previous convictions and that he was in custody since May 14th for probation violations.
And that would have triggered... You think it's objectively reasonable then to hold them to the standard that they should have inquired of the prosecutor or the detectives or somebody associated with law enforcement what that meant?
Or the reporter that interviewed them, yes. Any of those options would have been available to the Browns. And in the Allen case, all that was sufficient, the court didn't go into what was available from the prosecutor or the criminal file. All the court referenced was the fact that it had been in the newspapers, and had they simply read the newspaper, they would have been on notice of the prior felony conviction, which was all that was required to trigger a further inquiry notice duty on the plaintiff.
That is not the only basis upon which the Supreme Court reached its holding in Allen.
The court referenced the fact that the plaintiff had not continued her communications with the prosecutor's office, but there's no discussion of what she would have learned had she continued her communication with the prosecutor's office. In Allen, the plaintiff did not know that the perpetrator had even, who the perpetrator even was, let alone his criminal history, but she was held to constructive knowledge of the fact that the perpetrator had a criminal history, and that was sufficient to put the plaintiff on inquiry notice. In this case, the Browns have introduced no evidence of concealment, fraud, disability, or any other impairment on their ability to discover the factual basis for their cause of action. And the courts, in describing the evolution of the discovery rule, have described that is the reason for the discovery rule. It is that the plaintiff has lacked the means or the ability to ascertain the legal cause of action has accrued. And it either occurs when the plaintiff cannot reasonably know that they are injured at all, and then it was extended in Hibbard or in Ruth v. Dite, to when the plaintiff cannot know the cause of their injury. Both of those information, whether you limit it to the fact that Walker was the immediate cause or that DOC, according to the plaintiffs, was responsible for the murder, both of those informations were available to the plaintiff, and they could have known that information. There's no reason in the record that limited them from learning that information. The Hibbard case is also very dispositive, as well as the Allen case. In Hibbard, the issue was a Western State Hospital patient who also had a criminal history and who had murdered the plaintiff's parents and raped the plaintiff. The plaintiff only knew, if anything, who the perpetrator was, yet the court in that case held that the discovery rule would not toll the statute of limitations simply because she learned the rest of the information later, because the dispositive issue was that the information was available for her to learn as of the date of the crime. The test, as the court has recognized, is objective, and no reasonable persons can disagree in this case. We would ask the court to affirm the trial court's dismissal.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes.
We've somewhat glossed over the cause of action, but if you could address exactly what the cause of action is.
I'd be happy to.
As I understand it, it's the responsibility of DOC to supervise Mr. Walker, and that's a continuing obligation.
It is, Your Honor. It's a Joyce and Taggart duty, but it's an important point to make because in terms of the factual elements of the cause of action that my clients had to be aware of, one is the duty, which arises by virtue of the probationary status or community supervisionary status. The other is breach of that duty, which means that in order to bring a claim against DOC, it's not strict liability just because one of their offenders kills somebody on supervision. DOC, and they're actually tough cases to prove from a causation standpoint, because DOC has to be aware of other probation violations that the offender has committed and then fail to address them. Thirdly, with sufficient time for a DOC community corrections officer to arrest that person and bring them in for hearing, get them off the streets before the crime would be committed.
So does CP 79 put the Browns on notice of that cause of action?
It does not, Your Honor.
And why not?
Because it doesn't address the fact that there were prior probation violations before the murder, before the facts of the murder, including the possession of the firearm, that DOC was aware of. Those are alleged in our complaint, but we never got to them in discovery because the case didn't get that far.
Does Allen stand for the proposition that if they had read the article, if that was accepted, they would have had a duty to start sort of down this road of inquiry and figure out what was going on with him?
That's not my reading of Allen, Your Honor. And what I would say first and foremost in response to that is there's no body of law that says they have to read a specific Seattle Times article.
Or just
as a matter
say
of
the
law.
Media, let's say the media coverage in general on this case.
I would say what Allen is pointing us to is that if there's some notice that the plaintiffs have, they have a duty to continue an inquiry or engage in an inquiry. The Browns did that by following the trial court proceedings lockstep until they actually did discover the cause of action, and they brought it within 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you.